Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Sons of the Double Cheeseburger podcast. My name is Kevin Woosley, and I have with me Brandon Woosley.
I was not going to give my last name out, but that's fine. Now it's done. All
right. Shoot.
I thought we were using our assumed names, but anyway, it's too late. Okay.
All right, this is Kevin Slab Chest.
And I'm Brick Hard Cheese.
Hello, Mr. Hard Cheese.
It's good. How are you doing, Slab Chest?
I'm doing pretty good. Pretty good.
Yeah. So what's your week been like?
It's been getting cooler here, yeah. Which is nice. I like it cooler.
That is nice.
There's not been a whole lot going on. I'm doing like an hour's worth of census work every day.
Okay.
Which is not as efficient a use of my time, but...
So are you doing an hour's worth because that's really all that's there for you to do? Like that's all that's left?
Correct. Okay. Yeah. This area has had a particularly high rate of enumeration.
Good.
I'd like to think that's mostly due to my efforts, but... It is.
That's actually, I heard our president say that, so it's got to be true. So,
well, if you said it, then apparently I've not been doing very well at all. So yeah, but that's about it. Today is Mrs. Double Cheeseburger's birthday. Wait,
Mrs. Double Cheeseburger, I like that.
I guess your wife would also be Mrs. Double Cheeseburger.
Yeah, also Mrs. Double Cheeseburger, yeah. Not her birthday yet, though.
Yeah, so we were celebrating that a little bit, and
that was and so it. Your gift to her was to let her not have to spend time with you, and so you're talking to me.
That is correct. Yeah, she went to see a friend and perhaps enjoy a. A malted beverage or something, I'm not sure.
I'm hoping you mean a beer, or do you mean like a shake? I'm hoping you don't mean like a hard seltzer.
No, that okay. Hard seltzer is ridiculous, but...
So we'll save that for another show, but that is an abomination.
So, yeah, that's about it. How about you?
Well, things here have been getting a little bit better weather-wise. The fires are largely controlled in our immediate area now, and we still had some bad smoke, but that's last few days that's really cleared, so we're seeing the sky again. And, this time of year it's really funny because what I always thought of as fall, you know, like as you were saying, it's starting to get cooler where you are now in the Chicago area. We have sort of a little bit of a second summer out here. The summertime is sometimes not that warm. And then sometimes like September, October is actually a warmer time right here on the coast. So, and people who live here really enjoy that because then you get that extended season. Plus, all the tourists come during the summer and then they leave and the weather gets even better and they're not around. Which rules. So.
Everybody hates tourists.
Well, tourists are rough. They don't know what they're doing traffic wise. They clog up your lines at places. This year they bring viruses with them. You know, it's probably true that every year they bring viruses with them, but it's real notable this year. Plus what we've had a lot of was people would like come to us and think that once they left their hometown, it was they were also on a vacation from wearing a mask.
Oh yeah, yeah.
So that was pretty great. Enjoyed that.
Tourists are the virus, right?
They're one of them. There is no vaccine for tourists.
Yes, there is. You could be a real middling town.
It's true. When you're someplace as beautiful as Santa Cruz, California, there is no vaccine for tourists.
Right.
So, that's a shame.
Yeah, I was going to name a town that I thought, you know, may have vaccinated itself, but I don't want to insult anybody's town.
Well, inoculated against tourism?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I think the listener has someone in mind, has a place in mind. Everyone who's listening is saying, oh, yeah, like that place. Yeah, you're right.
Right, right.
That's the place.
Anyway. I tend to think that just about any place has something interesting about it, right?
Just about.
Maybe not. I mean, I think that. I shouldn't say right at the end, like, you have to agree with me. But I think there's something interesting everywhere. There's something that when you look at it, you're like, that was really, you know, either somewhat unique or unexpected. Or
Sure. I mean, I think that's accurate. It's also true that, you know, like any, there's some museums that I've gone to where I go through the place and in like 3 hours I'm done. And I think, well, that was great. I really enjoyed that. That was really interesting. And other museums where I could, you know, I can be there all day and not be done and want to go back again and again and again, right? So places are like that. There are probably some places where you're like, yeah, there was something interesting there and now I'm driving away. And
people are like that.
You know, oh, that's really the key. Because the reason that every place has got at least something interesting is that places have people. And, I mean, at least as we're talking about places, unless we're literally just talking about points on the map, you know, because then at that point I'd have to argue with you. Some places, some physical locations are not interesting at all. You get there and you're like, this is boring. I'm moving on.
Well, right. I mean, you could you end up out in the middle of a wheat field.
Yeah. I have driven this conversation straight into a ditch. Did you like that?
But what if there's something interesting in that ditch?
Well, that's what we're trying to find out.
Like, what if it was that wheat field where then a farmer found an old riverboat? Do you remember the story
from a number of years back? Yes.
Where the Mississippi had changed its course but left a boat high and dry, and it was underneath his farm field.
That's awesome.
Right? It was in the Mississippi, I think.
I believe that was. I believe that was also a subplot of Lost in one of the middle seasons.
I didn't ever watch Lost.
We'll cover that another time. Yeah. Okay. Right. Come back to that. Why not?
So I was thinking, I brought up a subject.
Yeah, you shared a news piece with me this week that I thought was great.
Yeah, so there's a gentleman by the name of Charles Finney.
Yep.
Good Lord. All right, starting again in 3, 2, 1. There's a gentleman by the name of Charles, or Chuck Finney, who was the one of the founders of the duty-free shoppers, the duty-free shops at airports.
Yeah.
And he had amassed quite a fortune. And his idea was he wanted to engage in philanthropy, but in a manner that actually involved giving everything away while he was alive.
Right.
And the news just hit this last week or so that he has finished giving away all of his money, and they have disbanded his philanthropic foundation, right.
Atlantic Philanthropy, was it?
Yes. I was, I don't know why. I was.
Sometimes words get away from you. It's okay. It happens to all of us.
It's happened to me twice, though, in like the last minute. So, as a philanthropist, he pioneered the idea of giving while living.
Yeah.
And indeed accomplished that. And so I thought that was an interesting thing to talk about, because the idea of philanthropy is nothing new, right?
Right.
And particularly philanthropy of the rich. you have foundations that exist now that were started by people that have been dead for 100 years.
Right.
And still have significant sums of money to give away.
I got a big grant 10 years ago from one of those foundations. Do you remember
was that Pfizer?
That was Lilly.
Lilly.
Yeah.
I'll see if I can get out of it. Let's see how many things I can get wrong tonight.
Yeah, I got a $50,000 grant from Lilly 10 years ago, which was a life changer for me. So here's the thing. Like, so one thing you haven't said yet, I don't think you said it already, is the volume of what his fortune was and what the foundation was giving away. And it was about $8 billion. Now, there were several things. I really like this article. There were several things about it that really stood out to me. One of them was it had never occurred, like, I've seen duty-free shops. And the fact that I've seen them, like, all over the world, it hadn't even occurred to me that was, like, a shop, like, that was a business somebody owns.
Right.
You know what I mean? I kind of almost thought that was, like, a function of government that had never... That may sound really stupid, but I realized I had never thought about, oh, like somebody ran the duty-free shops. Okay. And this was like the guy who had the idea as far as the way the article made it sound. And yeah, he ended up with a fortune of $8 billion. And so one of the things I think is so fascinating is that, like you said, he made the decision, we're going to give it all away. And he set up the foundation, I think, in 1984. He said, we're going to give it all away in my lifetime. Mm-hmm. So it took almost 40 years.
Right, so he's 89 years old now.
Yeah, yeah.
So and he's been giving away money, right, since he was in his...
50s.
Yeah, no, yeah.
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 It's been like 36 years. Yeah. So that's one thing like that's really amazing to me is... The decision, like $8 billion is what they're talking about that they gave away. The other thing, one of the other things that stood out to me is that he did it like completely anonymously. Right. For much of the time, the article goes into all these things, like for much of the time that it was going on, nobody knew who was giving these gifts. They were just anonymous gifts or they were known by very, very small pockets of people. There was an extended period of time where Forbes didn't know that he had given this money to the foundation. And so they were still attributing all of this wealth to him. And he was listed on Forbes' wealthiest Americans list as being a billionaire, even though when he started this foundation, he put all of his ownership of the company, all of his wealth, except $2 million into the foundation. So he put $8 billion in, kept $2 million for him and his wife to live on for the rest of their lives. And so he was appearing on the Forbes list as a billionaire when he was a millionaire, which is no small thing. But like that is really wild to me that he did it that anonymously for so long. And it was decades before they even started to let people in on the fact that there was this foundation and that that it was his wealth and that they were that it was being divested that rapidly.
Yeah, I think much of that even related to an intent or a desire to share that model of giving in terms of giving up dramatic sums of money,
yeah,
for philanthropic work.
And it has worked because some of the people, you know, the probably the philanthropic movement that some people maybe are most aware of at this point is that is related to this, that Bill Gates and Warren Buffett have been behind this pledge to have billionaires give away, you know, mega sums of their wealth,
committing to like half at least.
Yeah, right, exactly. And that he was Charles Feeney was the inspiration for them doing that. And so I think that's pretty amazing that, you know, all the press has ended up being about, and I'm not saying that like Gates and Buffett or any of those people have been like looking for that press, but all the press attention has been over there. And here this guy was just plugging away, giving away his $8 billion. You know?
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was really interesting. And I know there's a whole other line of conversation that, and I know that there's some, gosh, I should have prepared for this. I'll see if I can find this, and I'll put this into notes on the Facebook page. But I know there was a podcast series that was done, an investigative journalism piece, around some of the questions about philanthropy. Like there's a backlash to philanthropy at this point. People that are concerned that the philanthropists essentially, you know, can make massive social change and do so without any, without the consent of the people.
Right. Philanthropy as social engineering, mm-hmm. almost, trying to change the way people are educated or what people are taught, for instance, is one of those areas where there's concern that many have expressed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But setting that, I mean, that's a much larger conversation, and I don't know that I have anything really wise to say about that, but I'm really struck, you know, this guy, and I think one of the things you want to talk about was some of the specific projects that that Charles Feeney committed his money to. They feel pretty, I don't know the right word, they don't feel as partisan. They don't feel like they're terribly subject to that, any charge of like sort of having a bias or an agenda besides.
Well, I do think there are a couple that are pretty obviously biased.
Yes.
But I think a distinctive is that his projects tend to be, or his giving tends to support other people's ideas or needs. That he is supporting something that was brought to him as having a need.
Yeah.
As opposed to saying, this is how I think things should be, so I'm going to give a bunch of money to some people to try and put that into place.
Yeah. So, like, what were some of the ideas? You and I were talking a little bit offline. What were some of the ideas that really stood out to you, examples of that?
Right. So, you know, some area, well, and I think we should take maybe a half step back.
Okay.
He had a model of giving even beyond the idea of giving away everything. He had a model of giving that I think was in some ways different. Well, I think was significantly different than a lot of his, you know, philanthropy historically.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that he wanted to have everything given away while he was still alive. He didn't like the idea of just creating a foundation that would just be going on in perpetuity, that was almost like a business in and of itself, that it existed to continue existing,
right,
as well as then to give some. And I think what you see in some of these philanthropic models now is you get small, comparatively small sums of money given to large problems.
Right.
His idea was to identify a problem or have a problem identified to him, and to say, what do you need to make this happen, to fix this problem, and
right.
then to provide that. Something, he gave a significant sum of money to the, it was a $270 million grant to improve public health care in Vietnam. He gave $176 million to start the Global Brain Health Institute at UC San Francisco. Or he gave, one of the final gifts, it says here, was he gave the money to Cornell University to build a technology campus on Roosevelt Island in New York City. So instead of saying, I'm donating $2 million and put my name on the building, he said, here it is, just build it.
Right.
So that, you know, solving a problem, you know, in total, as opposed to chipping away at it.
Yeah, and I think, and I'm going completely off the top of my head here, so correct me if I'm wrong, or maybe someone else will inform me, but one of the things that I feel like there are some echoes in that of, like, for example, you look around, there's so many buildings, historic buildings in small towns, you know, libraries, other civic buildings that were built by Carnegie, right? Mm-hmm. And as I understand it, those are instances where, like, he paid for the whole thing.
Right.
Right. So that's sort of, it's different. And yet it's the seed of it is there, right? The idea that like, okay, you need this. Here's the money for that. Do the whole thing. As opposed to getting your name on a plaque or, you know, on a building, on the side of a building or something like that. If you've got the resources to just do the whole project, then just do the whole project and make sure it gets done.
Right. Philanthropy, I think, can often seem like a desire to continue to gain positive PR for someone after they're gone.
Right.
To, you know, to kind of ensure a certain amount of immortality.
Yeah. Which, again, the fact that he did so much of this anonymously and like, you know, that his name doesn't appear on these... so many of these things, and you know, that doesn't seem to have been his goal, like you said.
Right.
Yeah, I think that's. I mean, I think that's a really, it's a powerful idea. Like you said, the idea of like the healthcare system in Vietnam. My understanding is there's a university in Ireland that. He essentially funded the entire creation and startup of the university. So it's in a community that I think didn't have a university previously. Yeah, that kind of holistic giving, like if you have that volume of resource to get the whole thing done, I think that's a pretty amazing example. And again, he's not the only person to have ever done that sort of thing, but I agree with you that I think the combination of taking that approach with most of his giving, or so much of his, I think it's most of his giving, to take that approach where it's, we're going to identify projects that we can fully fund and doing it at the pace he's been doing it, that it's not about keeping something in perpetuity, but it is about completely investing this wealth in his lifetime. I think that's a pretty powerful combination. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, I think there's ways that you can look at that. I mean, I'm not somebody with $8 billion. Although if I had $8 billion, I could probably give most of that away. You know, that idea, you know, we said he kept, you know, about $2 million, mm-hmm. you know, for him and his wife to live on through their retirement. And that's certainly not a pittance. I'd take $2 million right now.
Sure.
You know, as, you know, but, when you hear about someone saying, I'm going to dedicate $5 billion to a cause over the next 30 years, but that person is worth $50 billion. And you say to yourself, are they even going to miss that $5 billion that they're giving away over an extended period of time, whereas it's invested anyway over that period of time, they're probably just giving away the interest, right. If even that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
In some ways... Where is the sacrifice in giving? Because I do think that there are some ways in which there's a value to, you know, there's the idea of give till it hurts. And I think that does make some sense. If you are committed to something, then do everything you can to help, to try and solve that problem. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't have to relate to actually giving money. You know, there's, you know, as I don't have $8 billion, but I can give my time.
Right.
I can give my support, my ideas, my effort, those sorts of things.
Yeah.
So I think there's the idea of identifying something and just going all in on it.
Sure.
And saying, all right, let's fix it.
Well, I do. I think there is something to be said for that. You know, and some of the big philanthropic movements or efforts of recent vintage have been trying to tackle problems that don't necessarily have a fixed price tag, right?
Right.
You know, we've talked about, for example, you know, efforts to eradicate certain diseases or to establish clean water or to build out like microfinance in some third world parts of the country or third world parts of the world. The third world parts of the country have Chase Bank. By the way, I forgot to tell you, Chase is a new sponsor of our podcast. No, they're not. They're really not.
No, thank you.
I wouldn't take it anyway. Anyway, but, you know, so some of that has been attempts to take on something where no one can say, here's what the price tag is.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so we're putting money into that. And as I was looking at some things, and we were talking about some of this earlier, that I think Gates Foundation, for example, has put like $1.5 billion or something like that into malaria research, right?
Right.
So they haven't solved it yet, but they haven't quit funding yet either. And so there are different kinds of things. There are things where you can say, I'm going to identify a problem, I'm going to completely solve it. I'm going to completely fund it, right? There are other kinds of problems where you can say it's so vast that it doesn't, like, no one else has felt like they could fund it. Maybe no specific government could fund it. Or the problem has gone on for so long that people have kind of despaired of resolving it. And so they've quit funding it. So there's room. I think there's room for both of those things. And, you know, the people who are investing their money in trying to eradicate certain diseases and things like that, that haven't finished the job yet and haven't run out of money yet, you know, hopefully they'll finish the job before they run out of money.
Right. Not every problem can just be solved
with
by saying, here is $100 million.
Yeah, right.
Some problems, you're still looking for the solution.
Right. But I agree with you absolutely that I think it's a really fascinating, like, this guy made a set of decisions. And even then, you know, I mean, maybe we could say this, because again, he did this in 1984. And his doing this has inspired billionaires in the last two generations to take hard looks at how they give. And so some of the ways that they give, whether it's the aggressive, like the speed at which they give, or the amount they're giving to projects, have been influenced by what Charles Feeney has done. They haven't necessarily completely taken on his method, but he's certainly changed that, the way that's being carried out by other people.
Yeah,
it's pretty great. You know, the other amazing thing is I'm thinking about the fact that it was 1984 that he set aside $2 million. And, $2 million, I think of it now, and I'm like, well, yeah, $2 million, we could live on that. Although where I live, I could barely buy a house with that. you could live on that. But, like, $2 billion or $2 million in 1984, like, would have seemed like crazy money to me. Right?
Yeah, well, I mean, we were probably making
$3.85 an hour.
It wasn't even legal for us to technically work.
It's true.
Right? So we were making however much we made delivering newspapers.
Yeah. I was getting ready to buy my first car in 1984. It's was rubbing my hands together, plotting. Mm. And Charles Feeney doesn't even own a car. Did you see that in the article?
No.
So there was 14-year-old Brandon was plotting buying a car, and I bought my own car the next year, 1985, for $500. Meanwhile, poor Charles Feeney didn't even have a car. What was I doing?
Well, you know. Not everyone can be Chuck Feeney.
It's true. So, anyway, thank you for bringing that to my attention. I did find the article kind of funny because the point they were making is the foundation has now closed. Mm-hmm. Their target had been to give away all of the money by 2016. I think that it's been like sort of wrapping that up and sort of finishing that up, but it's now officially done. No more foundation, no more board, no more any of that stuff. The way that Forbes put it is the man whose desire was to go broke, or the billionaire who didn't want to go broke, is now broke. I was kind of like, wait, he's not really, like, he's not personally broke, right? He doesn't, does he need it? Does he need us to do a GoFundMe? Because he's not dead yet. He's like, I'm still here. That would be a super weird twist on the very end of the story. Turns out Charles Feeney, previously a billionaire, is now on Medi-Cal. Has an apartment in San Francisco, and he goes to the food pantry in town. It's possible. I don't know.
Well, he's proven that we don't need billionaires.
No. It's true.
That money serves a greater purpose moving around than it does just accumulating with an individual.
You know, it's interesting. I just thought about this. Several of the people who have been heavily influenced by this approach are here in the San Francisco area where he has continued to live. I wonder if there's... I mean, I'm sure that he didn't plan that. He didn't know 40 years ago almost that San Francisco was going to end up being this really significant international financial hub because of the tech industry. But we have a really high concentration of super wealthy people.
Right.
It's pretty cool that he's been able to be right here in their neighborhood so that they could drive over to him to talk to him. All right. I like that. I'm glad. Thank you for bringing that article to my attention. Again, his name is Charles Feeney, and the most recent article, I think it came out earlier this week. It was in Forbes. So if you're interested in reading more about that, we could probably put a link on the Facebook page too, right?
Yeah, and there's a number of other articles, in The Observer and People. Irish Central. So he's reading about from the Irish perspective.
Because apparently a huge amount of his investment has been in Ireland, right?
Right, right. Yeah, helping to broker the peace in Ireland, which is no small thing.
No. Again, that would seem to be another one of those problems where it's like, who knows what the final check's going to be.
Right. Yeah, and in that sense, too, like when we look at, like the Gates Foundation, we know obviously that they're getting something out of it because they get to put microchips in everybody
and they
give them vaccines. Mm-hmm. That is not true.
What? It's not true? What is this itching on the back of my neck?
But I'll say this. For instance, if the work of the Gates Foundation can bring along a cure to malaria any faster, then that saves millions of lives.
Yeah.
And so even though that is not a situation where they're, like you say, having a fixed sum that addresses the problem, I will honor the commitment that has been made clearly to continuing to see that process through to try and get to the end result. So that's, you know, there, I mean, I read this article, I shared it with you, and even as we talked, there's so many more elements, to, you know, the ways it has me thinking about philanthropy and how philanthropy can work. So it's, yeah, I think if nothing else, I think most of our listeners would enjoy the read, because he was a pretty interesting gentleman, and maybe you'll have your own, you know, conversations as well that get you to thinking about the role of philanthropy in society and the role of, you know, having like a personal philanthropy, you know, whether it's money or something else.
Right.
I think that's something, it's worth having a deliberate conversation with yourself.
Yeah. Being intentional about how you, again, whether your resource is financial or your abilities or your time or whatever it may be, but being intentional about how you're using that and what your, you know, what your aims and your goals are. Yeah. Well, and I got to say this, just between you and me, Kevin, because at this point, no one else is listening. But Anchor does not tell us they give us a lot of data on the people that listen, but they don't tell us anything about how much, like what their personal wealth is.
Hmm.
So we don't know that there are no billionaires listening. It may be that we got some billionaires in our audience that are going to learn about Charles Feeney.
Did you indicate that we had a listener in Ireland?
Yeah, we did. Yeah. Hopefully they're still there. I mean, hopefully they're listening again. I mean, there's so many ways that sentence could go, and they all went wrong.
No, I left Ireland.
I heard this podcast and I came to America. Oh, wow, my accent was horrible. Okay, I gotta fix something. I'll edit that in post.
We are horrible people.
But yeah, hopefully we didn't drive anyone from Ireland. Like the snakes being driven out by St. Patrick.
Oh, dear Lord.
Hopefully. And hopefully our Irish listener decided to give us another go. That'd be pretty cool. Yeah.
Absolutely. And I hope they've told all their friends. And yes.
And drinking buddies.
It'd be just our luck that we would only reach people who don't have friends.
Somehow that seems like that.
That our audience would be representative of who we are as people.
It's weird, isn't it? Your audience finds you. That's what it turns out to be. So it's like I'm looking in a mirror. So
Chuck Feeney, and you can go to the Atlantic
Philanthropies
website. Yeah, and there's a lot of information they give there about what had been the work of the. Of that organization.
Oh, so who's paying for the website now? Oh, I got a little.
Mm. Oh, no, now there's doubt is creeping something in.
Oh, maybe they put it on, I don't know, maybe they put it on like AOL. That'd be awesome. Because he started this in the 80s, you know, probably like he's like, all right, so our email, our website is on AOL. We're going to save money that way. So we just left it there.
There's a book there about the work of the foundation called Zero is the Hero that talks about where the money went.
Cool. Some
various facts and figures. You can download it for free. So, and I like to use the phrase, Zero is my hero. Mm-hmm. Like when you go shopping and
And I like things that are free.
Show me the person who doesn't.
you know what? We're not going to turn this into a political conversation.
All right, so
speaking of Ireland, as we start to wrap up, we already pointed people to the Sons of Double Cheeseburger page at Facebook. owned by another billionaire who's working on giving away his wealth. Not successfully, but...
Now, go ahead.
So you can reach us there. We've been telling you to send your letters and cards, packages, things like that, to our P.O. Box in Calhoun, Colorado.
Yeah.
But that needs to stop. Don't if you got something sitting there to go out in the post tomorrow, pull it back. Because, we had to make a break with Calhoun. It turned out, some of you maybe remember the story that they have a grocery store called Woolsey's. And so what we really felt was going to happen here was we were going to bring that big double cheeseburger prestige to town. And then the grocery store is going to change its name to Woolsey's, like the proper spelling. And there's a lot of back and forth. A lot of it, honestly, was very similar to the negotiations between Roku and Comcast about whether or not they would put the Peacock app on Roku. Very similar to that. And in the end, they said, no, we're not changing the name. And harsh things were said. I think it's fair to say harsh things were said. And Calhoun asked us to leave. So, I needed to take responsibility for some of this, which is why I'm telling you all of this instead of Kevin.
I'm a little blindsided by this.
I made the mess. I got to clean it up a little bit here. So, at any rate, we don't have a post office box in Calhoun anymore. But the good news is Kevin had already done some really beautiful advance work.
Yes.
In case we were going to need to move someday. So, Kevin, can you tell people where we're sending it to now?
I can. I would be delighted to tell people that we are going to go a little bit farther east.
You need a drum roll?
Sure.
I'm not that good a drummer, so don't make me go too long on this.
Just stop. There we go. We will be setting up shop in Seneca, Missouri.
Yeah, Seneca, Missouri.
Yeah.
I was assuming that, again, when we talked, that it was named for the Greek philosopher or politician.
No.
You told me that was incorrect.
I did tell you that, because it is incorrect.
Okay. Well, so it's named for who?
It's named for the...
Seneca Wallace, the failed football player?
It's possible that that's the case if Seneca Wallace was named after the Seneca Indian tribe.
By the way, I'm really embarrassed because Seneca was a Roman, not a Greek.
Oh my God.
Egg on my face. Jeez. First I get us kicked out of Calhoun and now I get Seneca wrong. Okay, I want to let you talk for a minute. I'm ashamed.
So Seneca, Missouri is a small burg. On the Missouri-Oklahoma border. Okay.
Nice.
It's
near Joplin, is that right?
It is. It's in that Joplin region. Yeah.
I see here that it's part of the Joplin, Missouri Metropolitan Statistical Area.
That would be it.
I've now learned that such a thing exists.
Yeah, see? So, some things about Seneca, its population is, 2,387, that's estimated as of, 2019. It was founded in 1869, and the post office called Seneca has been in operation since 1869 as well.
Great.
So there's some continuity there, and I think that's something that we frankly could use.
This is, you know, the other thing I like about this is this is not a place where the Postal Service inadvertently renamed the town because they goofed up.
Right.
Which we've had several times now. So it's good. It's good. They were respecting the Seneca Indians perhaps more than I was. My apologies to the Seneca.
Yeah, so something I noticed is that I'm learning something here. If you look at land area, or you know, sometimes you'll get a total area of a community, like 2.56 square miles in this instance, mm-hmm. and how much of that is split up between land and how much is water.
Yeah.
The indication I'm seeing is that all of it is land, but I remember driving over a creek. So do creeks not count?
That's a really great question that I don't know the answer to.
I mean, I'd have been impressed if you knew
the answer. Oh, actually, I'm looking at a picture right here on Wikipedia, and then the picture is of a bridge over a creek taken from Oneida Street.
Yeah. So...
So yeah, maybe creeks are not counted as, maybe waterways don't count at, like in the same way as a body of water. Could that be it?
That must be it. That's the only thing I can think of. Maybe because the water is moving.
Maybe.
So it's never staying in one place.
You can't pin it down. It's like water under the bridge, specifically that bridge that you can see from Oneida Street.
Mm-hmm. Is it demonym? That's what you call someone who is from an area?
Yeah.
They're either a Senecan or a Senecanian.
All right.
So that's interesting that there's two choices. I would have gone with the first one. That's when it would have made sense to me. But...
I would have gone with Senate Canadian.
Am I the only person who likes to call Canada Canadia?
No, I like that very much.
Because why aren't they Canadians then?
In fact, I think you should call it Canadia, but then refer to the residents of Canadia as Canadians. Mess with them.
So... What else would you like to know about Seneca?
Famous people? Anyone big from there? I don't mean tall or fat.
There is someone
significant in the public.
There's someone named Little Britches. Little Britches was an outlaw in the American Old West associated with Cattle Annie. Now, are you familiar with Cattle Annie?
I'm not.
Oh, see, we found a rich vein to mine here.
Have we?
Their exploits are fictionalized in the 1981 film. Now you'll remember it. The 1981 film Cattle Annie and Little Britches, directed by Lamont Johnson and starring Diane Lane.
Wow.
As Little Britches.
1981. That's early Diane Lane. Wow.
But Cattle
Annie. Who played Cattle Annie in that?
Oh, Amanda Plummer. That was her film debut.
I want you to be telling me the truth, but you're not, are you?
No, I am.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm getting this movie. All right. All right, future episode, we're discussing Cattle Annie and Little Britches.
So, yeah, there's some... Yeah, so
that makes me sad though. Then if Plummer played Catalani. I wish that Little Bridges had been played by Tim Roth. Think about how great that would have been.
Well, that would have been great.
They're good people in this movie. So you know who Scott Glenn is? He's good. You'd know him. He's got one of those like really weathered American kind of faces. He's in this movie. Michael Conrad, who played the guy in Hill Street Blues that would tell everyone, be careful out there.
He's in this movie. Is Ned Beatty in this film? It seems like a movie Ned Beatty would be in.
He's not.
But doesn't it?
It kind of does.
Starting to get a Ned Beatty feel to it.
It kind of does. There's a dude named John Savage who really looks like he's the
Savage.
Stunt double. Yeah, he looks like he's the stunt double for from Breaking Bad, Walter White. I just lost his name. Malcolm in the Middle. Why can I not think of this actor's name?
The guy from Malcolm in the Middle?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
And Breaking Bad.
Yeah, he's probably one of my two favorite
Bryan white Cranston.
Male, yeah, white male actors.
Yeah, John Savage looks like Bryan Cranston.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, there's Amanda Plummer. There's Diane Lane. Burt Lancaster's in this. Oh my goodness. All right. Rod Steiger's in this movie, dude.
Oh, I thought you were going to say Rod Stewart. I was going to be like, that's...
Okay, now it's moving off the list.
A little far afield.
No.
Dudley Moore.
And Rod
Benny Hill.
The story of a couple of 19th century Midwestern... Outlaws, starring Dudley Moore and Benny Hill. Yeah. Scored by Rod Stewart.
No.
Hey, but Rod Stewart was scoring in 1981.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
So there's Catalani and Little Britches. Other people.
This
one is a deep cut. Notable people from Seneca. Morris Watts, former assistant football coach at Michigan State University.
Okay.
So that's you've probably got to be a big Sparty fan too.
That's a deep cut for a Sparty fan, even right.
Scott Albert, a. Short-time relief pitcher for the Dodgers.
Okay.
Actually, was pretty good. Yeah. The Dodgers seem to always have about 30 guys they could bring up and post a 3 ERA in the bullpen anyway. So. And Steve Gaines, the guitarist for Lynyrd Skynyrd, up until the point when he couldn't play anymore. In October of 1977.
Yeah, except I gotta tell you, there's a little more to that Steve Gaines story even. So he was the guitarist until the plane crash in 1977.
Mm-hmm.
But he became guitarist for Lynyrd Skynyrd in 1976. So he wasn't original to the band. In fact, his sister joined the backup singers group.
Yeah.
And then she, like, said, hey, I got a brother who plays guitar. So they said, well, let him get on stage and play with the band. And so he did. And the band, afterwards, the band was like, yeah, we couldn't hear him. I don't know. But apparently the sound guy was like, he's great. Keep him. And so they did. And then the plane crashed. So that's worth a movie right there.
Yeah, so his sister, he and his sister were both from Seneca, Cassie and Steve. Apparently Cassie survived the crash, but then died before rescuers could reach her.
Cool.
And a sad little note, Steve and Cassie Gaines's mother was killed in an automobile accident right by the cemetery where the two of them were buried.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, that is a sad story.
I will... I'll mitigate it a little bit. Cassie Gaines, in late 1975, Gaines, and then two other people formed a trio called the Honkettes.
Yeah.
A female gospel vocal trio.
Yeah. Love that.
Lynyrd Skynyrd, the Honkettes. So
I don't know what that even means. By the way, the director, I thought we were going to finish early, but let's follow this a little bit. Lamont Johnson, who was the director of Catalani and Little Britches.
Yes, we're good. We're back there.
Was only minimally known as a director. He only directed a few times. He was primarily known as an actor. Some of his most prominent acting roles were in Gunsmoke. Mm-hmm. In 1967, he was in an episode of Gunsmoke in which he is credited only as Stoner.
Cool.
He was in the TV show The Felony Squad. He was in The Big Valley. He was in Profiles in Courage. He was on a TV show. I am not joking. He was on a show called The Brothers Rico, which I'm now thinking we should rename the podcast.
Brothers Rico?
Brothers Rico, yeah.
Mm.
There was a TV show in 1956, at least, that was called TV Reader's Digest.
Does sound terrible.
Yeah. So anyway, he was in some great stuff, really powerful stuff. And then he capped it all off by making Catalani and Little Britches. And I'm telling you, I'm gonna watch that movie.
Yeah, I gotta see if that's on Amazon or Comcast.
I'm looking for where we find that. Yeah, it's got to be somewhere.
So something else interesting about Little Britches, I always find things like this particularly interesting. You know, her and Catalani were eventually apprehended, sent to jail. Little Britches was paroled because of poor health. And from there, no one knows what happened to her.
So she was paroled and then, like, made a run for it?
Yeah, I mean, she apparently lived in the same town as the prison where they were imprisoned.
Wow.
In Framingham, Massachusetts.
Framingham, nice.
Yeah, yeah. But that's it. Yeah. So she doesn't have a death date. So either she's lived a long life.
That's pretty wild.
Or she just disappeared.
It looks like Catalani and Little Britches, you can buy it on Blu-ray.
Really?
Yeah. Apparently it's also on Turner Classic Movies.
Oh.
There you go.
Well, with that... that cast, I'm not surprised.
No. All right, folks. Well, that's your homework. You got two things. Read Charles Finney's book, or Charles Feeney's book, not Charles Finney's book. That's totally different. We weren't talking about theology this week.
It's not Albert Finney. It's not Charles Finley.
No.
The owner of the A's.
No.
Another Bay Area individual, though.
He sure was.
It is.
Charles Feeney. You read his book, and then you you watch Catalani and Little Britches, and then come back here next week for another episode of Sons of the Double Cheeseburger.
Mm-hmm.
All right?
If in the meantime you can make $8 billion...
give it away.
Yeah, well, we'll help you with that.
Mm-hmm. If you need our help. But again, show some initiative. If you make $8 billion this week, give it away.
All in 1 week?
I mean, that'd be impressive, right? We would talk about that.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, in most cases, like, I think there are weeks that that Jeff Bezos makes $8 billion.
Yeah, I saw that, billionaires have added something like $400 billion to their net worth.
Yeah.
Through the course of the pandemic.
Yep. Everybody's suffering.
I don't know that that's how, well, either that's not how capitalism is supposed to work, or maybe that's a part of capitalism that doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
Like maybe we need to, that's a flaw
yeah.
in capitalism.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I would agree.
But anyway. All right. So yeah. So it's Sons of the Double Cheeseburger, P.O. Box 77, Seneca, Missouri. And the zip code is 64865.
Wow.
All right.
Nice.
We are also on the gram, Instagram now. I'm working on putting some of the content that had been also on Facebook onto Instagram so that that's all caught up.
All right. So on Instagram, what are we? Are we at?
We're at
Sons of the Double Cheeseburger. All right.
If you search for Sons of the Double Cheeseburger, I would assume that we are what comes up.
Sure enough. In fact, I only put in Sons and we showed up. Mm. Oh, that's because I'm following us already. Well, all right. All right. Kevin, it's been good talking to you.
Yes, and We will both have birthdays probably by the time
this
happens again, right?
That's very likely.
So you will be very old. I will be not.
Watch it.
But this is a big year for you, isn't it?
Maybe.
It's a
round number year.
Yeah.
That's true.
So, you figure out what you're going to do for your 30th birthday, and we will...
And for you, this is a birthday that's a multiple of 8, right?
Yeah.
Those are pretty notable.
Yeah.
Those multiple of 8 years.
Whew.
Yeah. All right.
We will talk to you all later. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.